Yeah, we could just catch up, and because you were thinking of a cultural a part on the culture issue, right? And that's quite distinct.
Yeah, I mean, someone had suggested it, and it just dawned on me, like, you know, there's this huge subjective rift between you know, the way that I think a lot of people around the world see the world versus how mm-hmm. Americans, how we see the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I can kind of sense this just because, like, I spend so much time around Chinese people, you know, and then,
right.
But then I spend so much time, you know, around work and my friends and stuff. And there is, you know, there is no reconciling the two. And if I tried, I would probably go crazy. You have to compartmentalize because they're just so different. Like the way, you know, even the way I, you know, relate to my family and my in-laws and stuff. And, you know, it's just, you know, it just dawned on me. I'm like, there's no reconciling this rift. It's not a matter of translation. It's a matter of like fundamental orientation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a huge issue. We should do a whole part on this if we're not doing it now.
But, yeah.
They're very interesting kind of philosophical issues behind it, which we don't have to get into, but just on a level of feeling and a level of experience, I agree with you, actually. And it's interesting that we're taught not to notice this. We're taught to deny it because I think it's part of this whole liberal ideology that these things really can be reduced to something else. You're all it's just the same, but yeah.
It's also just a difference in there's just sort of like a horizon beyond which we in the West, like, we just can't, in America in particular, like, it's hard for us to see over, which is why, like, I don't know, I just feel like Americans have become so close-minded about the rest of the world in a way that frankly is a lot worse than it used to be, but I think that the seeds of it were always there. But we're starting to realize, like, the rest of the world is not going to just kind of like turn into us, right? Like, this is not a world in which you know, we're just waiting for everyone to catch up to us, you know, like, it's just a matter of time and maybe effort, but eventually the whole world will become just like us. And when they do become like us, we view it as progress. And I think that's over, you know, that's just over. Like, the idea, I mean, meaning like the hope of that is over. Even that concept as a positive idea is over. And the result of that is, you know, a pretty lost, like, present. I think people in America are kind of like scrambling to figure out what still makes sense, and, you know,
this is really interesting now you're making, there's a really interesting connection here to the actually to the geopolitics that
we often discuss
because you're describing actually a social moment, a cultural moment of realization of the end of this notion, but it's also, you know, it's also a huge thing in basically in our social scientific framing of the world, the whole epistemology with which, you know, the West confronts or tries to understand the world. And that's to do with the convergence hypothesis, which is just another way of saying what you just said, that it's going to converge to America, basically. Converge to this basic ideology, this basic view of the world, you know, what exists, right? What the basic units are. There's individuals and then their desires and so on and so forth, right?
I think the really tricky part of it is, like, you know, I remember when America was more, you know, had more confidence and thought that, you know, believed in the convergence theory. But it was, you know, it was an undoubted good, right? Because we thought we were living a great life. Why shouldn't the rest of the world live a great life just like us? You know, yeah. It wasn't, I don't think for your average person, it was motivated by anything terribly sinister. Now, the geopolitics around at that level, that's a different story.
Yeah.
But I think even there, they, you know, the people in power had that crutch to say, ultimately, this is, you know, a worthy goal. And so it just gave the country like a unifying sort of purpose and self-satisfaction. Yeah. But when you take that away, the question is like, when you take that away, you know, what do we have left? And I kind of sense like it wasn't just America, like when America sort of lost its primacy, we should just talk about it in either the present or the past tense, because I think it's already happened. But I think what I'm seeing is that around the world, a lot of places in the wake of the receding of American, not America, like America's still dominant in a way, you know, but when it's receding in the idea that America sort of is a guiding North Star, right, for like mm-hmm. human mm-hmm. development in mm-hmm. history, mm-hmm. you see regression. You see that when that the rug gets pulled, that a lot of societies, a lot of countries around the world, or whatever unit you want to measure it in, like they sort of fall back on earlier forms and earlier norms that kind of sustain them. So I think like that came out, like for example, when Tucker was interviewing Putin, and Putin was like, "Oh, let's begin in the 12th century."
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, things are going. Yeah, you know, like people are.
And he wasn't doing it ironically.
He was not. Yeah, and I don't think he was just wasting his time or anything. He was like, if you really want to understand it, here's how we think about it, and that means that people have to draw on organizing principles that existed prior to the simplicity of just sort of like American unipolarity. The question is, what about us? What about Americans? What do we fall back on? I don't think we have much to fall back on. That's the problem. The periods in history that we may want to look to are either too problematic, or the country's just too radically changed since then.
And the problem is that it's kind of ruled out. The idea that you need something to fall back on, that's been ruled out in a way by this kind of by this late stage of liberalism. You know, the earlier one, I mean, even Tocqueville mentioned, right, that you know America is sustained not just by democracy, in a formal or de jure democracy, but by its civil society organizations. That's what we call it today. But it's small associations and societies by people volunteering, helping one another out. You know, it's all that other stuff that's sort of ruled out. First became invisible, and then were quite systematically attacked. So that it even rules out this path to resuscitation or renewal. I think in their own mindset or ideologically, there shouldn't be this. All you need is these very bare ideas. I think one point I want to, you know, one thing I want to bring up is this: the relationship between this convergence, this idea of convergence, which is, you know, it's also part of thought of as modernization theory, as countries become, you know, more modern, richer, more successful, they'll all converge to liberal democracy, right? I think it's attached to American exceptionalism. That is that the United States is the model for this. And that really bolsters the exceptionalism. It's, you know, if the U.S. exceptionalism wasn't founded on this from the start, it certainly is now. That is not only that it is the custodian, the exemplar of democracy, but you know that it's exceptional in this regard and has special rights, and indeed actually in the global system it has a super sovereign status relative to other countries because it is the custodian of this, and that it's a project. Once you take that away, you're taking everything out of the geopolitical project. If you want to ask why is America so hell-bent on supremacy, you couldn't understand it if you took this out. I mean, what is it all for? We were talking earlier about the ridiculousness of NATO being about to declare itself kind of global, or its intention to globalize itself. This monster, right? Why? For what? Right? What is it for? I mean, if you took that this convergence thing or this modernization thesis away, what is it left with? Nothing.
You know, I think the tie, from my perspective sitting here in America, is that part of our reflex towards dominance is because we have a deep fear that we wouldn't know what to do otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really that simple. I don't really think it's just, I mean, it is about greed, you know, it is that, but there's an obverse and negative side to that too. I mean, greed is negative, but what I mean is, like, there's a shadow side to that too, I think, which is that there's a fear, and it's a palpable fear now, that I think people are experiencing at an individual level. I know I am to a degree, and it's not unique to me. I'm just feeling the energy around me, I'd say, is that if you take away some of the load-bearing beliefs, I'd call them, you're left with a fear that the whole thing is going to come crashing down. And I do think that there real and justifiable panic right now. We're borderline panicking about what will happen when the ultimate structure that holds everything up comes falling down. And one by one, we're seeing, okay, that pillar, it can come down, but things won't, like, a lot of pillars have come down and the whole thing's still standing up. I do think that we kind of know that if the financial pillar comes down, the whole thing is up, right? If we have another banking or economic crisis, you know, I don't know how well we're going to be able to navigate that peacefully and orderly. You know, much less, you know, forget about anything relating to the contingencies of there being some kind of war or a draft or, you know, whatever. You know, I think the real panic for me, on top of all that stuff, which is real, is that we're the U.S. economy is really propping a lot of this up, and in the monetary privilege that we have, we're living off our dollar, and no one really has an idea about when that thing's going to, you know, there's just too much stress on the system, it's going to break. Absolutely nobody knows, and so nobody can reassure anyone that that's not going to happen. And so panic abounds. And I think if we see the whole thing come down to a degree, all bets are off. That's what I think. I think all bets are off.
I think that's the event horizon of the thing is a kind of financial collapse. Another possible one would be the outbreak of war with either Russia or China.
Yeah.
That is a peer conflict. But even short of that, where we are right now with Ukraine, with the war in Ukraine, I think the elites feel that panic over this ending in defeat, you know, that is well short of the financial collapse scenario. They're behaving as if, well, if we seem to lose this war, that's it for us.
Yeah.
You know, that's quite terrifying, because that's a war that's already lost. It's the same thing with, they keep doing this. They keep creating they keep creating their own crisis. And there's a, you know, what you describe actually helps explain what would otherwise be a kind of excess of affect or of passion over these things. There's no realist response to anything. It's always, you know, existential. That's their favorite word now, right? But it's existential in the way you described. for their sense of themselves, I think. In a psychological sense, you know, existential ideologically Absolutely. And psychologically, but in the deep psychological sense, you know, our collective psychology. It's as if you know we're not going to be able to hold our shit together anymore if we lose in Ukraine or we lose the next election. It just keeps getting nuttier and nuttier.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, people got to get out of bed, you know, they got to get out of bed and they got to do shit. And the question is, what do you do and for what purpose? And like, think about like all the people that have built their life around this kind of thing. Like mm-hmm. all of suburban Washington, D.C. and, you know, the whole political elite. And, you know, it's almost like, and I can see this like with a lot of the things that happen or that are happening around the world, like what Israel's doing. It's like, in a way, when you push for the more, like, it's almost like a sunk cost thing where it's like the more you've invested in something, the harder it is to let it go.
Absolutely.
And the U.S., the ruling class right now, if they let it go, I mean, like, let's take Ukraine for an example. Like, they're going to have to admit that they're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a gambler at the casino on a bad streak and, who's doubling up all the time.
And how are they going to explain that? How are they going to explain mm-hmm. that they were wrong mm-hmm. or that they couldn't, you know, that they were wrong about, they couldn't fight. They couldn't do it. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel
there's
like
a bunch of words that keep coming up, right? A bunch of descriptions that I keep seeing about their behavior. People keep saying, I don't know, this is insane. This is delusional. In other words, there's something we cannot understand, sort of seemingly irrational in this. And another word that keeps coming up is these people are doubling down. But you put that together yes. in an image of a guy at the roulette table or something on a losing streak who keeps doubling up his chips, right? That's easier to understand. You know, it's desperation and continuing doubling down. And you see that in the reaction to, in how they treated Joe Biden's dementia. It's insane. Yeah, I mean, how did you think you were going to get away with that? So you keep doing things you think you can, that you couldn't possibly get away with. And you keep doing that and you think you can get away with it by just putting enough chips on the table. And these are your narratival chips, you know. They're all in the virtual.
It's sad.
You tell, you keep telling the story, right?
I feel like there were two great tests recently. Mm-hmm. There are two great tests. I thought COVID was a test. And I think climate change is an ongoing test to see if, you know, we could have taken that as, you know, a peaceful off-ramp to say, maybe we have, maybe there's another global priority that we can take a lead on and work with the rest of the world. But that's just not going to happen. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when I think people might have said, hey, that's a possibility mm-hmm. for the United States. And I think there was some talk about that, you know, and I think even mm-hmm. Biden had kind of pushed such ideas but it's not in any, like, those are completely failed tests. And what we'd rather do is fight these obscene wars.
They're tests, I agree. And they're also almost like, you know, cosmic and Shakespearean ruptures in the universe. You have plague. And you have sort of disorder in the heavens, you know, yeah. COVID. And then on the other hand, you have climate change. So these are also, apart from being tests, they are, you know, if you look at it from either a Shakespearean, classical European perspective or even a Chinese perspective, these are really signs of an end. They are... I keep going back to it. They're revelatory moments. They prompt. These are crises, which then accelerate. They're both a sign of things not going well, but they also accelerate the process, the decline.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really quite a moment. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it almost feels like, you know, there's, I mean, you could feel the course of history returning. Like you could see Absolutely. Things happening. There's something yeah. with yeah. a capital S happening. And it's a big thing and it's not clear what it is, but it's something. Something's changing and yeah. everyone feels it. Everyone knows it. And going back again to this idea that, you know, in those times, I think you revert to, you know, things that do fall apart, like you revert to prior norms to kind of catch you. And some people have that here. Some people have, you know, families to fall back onto in terms of, you know, I think people right now are kind of like re-centering family life to a large extent. A lot of workers in America don't want to go back into the office precisely because they don't want to burn 2.5-3 hours per day for no reason when they could just be at home and maximizing time there. They don't want to go back. They'll quit, you know, they'll get fired over going back. And, you know, people are just kind of dropping out, you know, they're just like, it's not worth it. I mean, what is the purpose here? If I'm desperately in need of cash, yeah, you know, but, I mean, even then, I think a lot of people, younger people especially, are just sort of like, you know what? I don't give a shit.
That's But that's intermediate, right? Going back to families, it's kind of an intermediate and personal solution. It doesn't address the cultural issue that you raised at the start of this.
Yeah, especially because, you know, some people are going to be lucky enough to have that, but then other people, you see a lot of this. I mean, you just see a lot of social pathology right now. You see a lot of just crazy fucking behavior and degenerate behavior that, you know, we've grown fearful of maybe calling it out, but I think people are losing their shyness around it, going like, people are not behaving in acceptable ways right now. Yeah. Like, it's...
Yeah. Yeah, it's not so. You know? It's not a societal answer. It's a private answer. I mean, I'm not knocking it. It's people have to survive, and it's really important to have family and to have something to go back to. But it doesn't solve that larger question that you posed. I mean, what do you retrieve? What culture do you retrieve if you have a notion of a history of yourself as always being on the cusp, on the cutting edge of progress, and your self-esteem or your identity comes from that, then by definition, everything you left behind, you know, is unsatisfactory and to be discarded. You're still discarding the past in terms of certain deep cultural norms, for example, over gender. That has a chronological dimension, that has a historical dimension. You know, you're just discarding that. And it's really deep. Because the ideology itself prevents you from looking for an answer here, because you have a linear or up and up conception of time, right? You don't have an end of historical development. Things shouldn't ever go back to where they were before. We've discussed this before, I think, right? About
I mean, I think the way forward for America is just forward. Mm. Like we have to be more forward thinking, and we can't. I think the amount of nostalgia and the idealization of the recent past in America is everywhere, and there's a real desire to, you know, they're resuscitating media franchises from the 1980s and, you know, all this stuff. And it's people are trying to live in the past a little bit, but I think ultimately, the way forward is like you got to go forward. We can't just keep looking back in the past.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm
as guilty of that as anyone.
No, I mean, nostalgia is degenerate in a way, a decadent form of, historical retrieval. It's not cultural retrieval. It's precisely different from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nostalgia is just wanting the form and the feeling without anything else. I just want that sort of image of the 60s or 90s or whatever. And it's become something you consume. So that's not the way, that's just a sign of trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I think so
too. I mean,
too.
If you're like the Russians connecting, able to have something to bank on, to draw on, then you or like the Chinese, you actually are not concerned about, you're not particularly, you're not nostalgic actually. You will cut and paste and play and reuse things from your past, from what is supposed to be the past, as if they were entirely present. The past becomes entirely present, not some sort of piece of nostalgia, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You live in, you will again live in the present. I think that's the paradox.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. I don't know what's I really don't. I mean, I just feel like I have no idea what other people here are up to or thinking. It's like kind of everyone's thinking different things, maybe. I have no idea. It's a very confused time. And yeah. I mean, total loss of faith in the mm-hmm. political system, like mm-hmm. rampant, you know, the debate did not help. You're looking at just total dysfunction.
Yeah.
In politics, and everyone's sick of it. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody is happy with this.
Yeah. Total loss of faith in the information ecosystem, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the extent that we are people who are very reliant on it or live in that space a lot, right? You're reading, consuming media, and then you realize, I mean, the question of the day is, what else have they been lying to us about?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's distressing. That's why I appreciate these conversations with you.
It's super distressing.
Because of all the content.
Yeah. It's super distressing. I don't know what to say, man. I mean,
neither do I.
Yeah. It's a weird, there's no future. Like, it's just really hard to imagine the future. Like, very few people are talking about next year. You know, very few people are talking about, you know, any big plans that America's got cooked up, any project, anything to look forward to. I think people are just sort of dreading the idea of the future almost. And so it's just weird. It's a weird stuck in time moment here. And I got no answers, man. I got nothing. I'm just like, yeah, that's just what it is.
You know, I just thought of a way in which this actually speaks to the theme that you to your prompt for this conversation earlier about the sort of incommensurability of Chinese and Western culture.
Yeah.
Well, this is real incommensurability because and this is culture not as a settled, you know, a thing itself, but as lived experience. I don't have an answer to this. I just step out of it. You know, I live in China. I live in Asia. Yeah. And I don't have these problems at all. And you can't, as you put it, you can't bring these together. I cannot explain this. You just have to step out of being in this condition, which is not a universal condition. It's a Western condition.
Yes. Yep.
And you, there's no way to explain it to people in there that actually, no, it doesn't feel like that in other places and it doesn't have to feel like that. But I can't reconcile it with your worldview or your way of being in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's a way, the outside world, the world outside of the West that is still living under, I'd call it just traditional culture.
Mm-hmm.
To us as Americans, I mean, we always viewed that as a step back, right?
Yeah.
Like, why would you do that? That's you're holding on to these. I mean, some of it's charming, you know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, you respect your history or whatever, but like fundamentally speaking, you know, you should be modernized people with a few accoutrements of your past as culture, cultural reminders, but to actually live within the confines of that culture to us was considered unevolved.
Yes.
And so now it's like there's a fear. I mean, even short of the fact, even us not subjectively understanding what that is even means, right? Mm-hmm. On the surface, there's already a fear, because it's kind of like, that's a step into the past that, like, why would we step 200 years into the past or whatever? Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
we're not going to do that.
Yeah. But that's the framing of the past, of the modernization thesis, right? Of the convergence thesis. And here's a thought. Here's a suggestion or a hypothesis. My hypothesis is that in places like China today, today's China, they're just breaking out of that whole framing of, you know, wonderful kind of modernity and terrible past. They're just breaking out of it. Mm-hmm. Imagine not thinking about the past in that way, in that, you know, automatically derogatory, automatically kind of discrediting way. If it's just all there, you live with the past as a sort of present, in a way, to describe that. Imagine that, because I think this is one of the deeper implications of the abandonment of the convergence or modernization hypothesis, right? It's not going to... You'll need to understand it from outside the theory itself. It's such an encompassing theory, actually, because you know it's so easy to be captured by it. All your points of reference, your whole cartography, right, is defined by it. Your whole mental map is defined by it. To just step out of it and not think in those terms. And to be thinking naturally in another way, I think that's just happening quite naturally in other parts of the world, not captured by this. Yeah. And it's not just in the US, right? You see it all over Western Europe in the kind of cultural crisis of the West. What is it all for? Where is it headed? I don't see any program, you know. Yeah. I don't see any program. I think in Europe, the populist thing is kind of you know, return or reactionary, but in a, I think it's more nostalgia, and it's more, you know, it is reactionary in the bad sense, you know, just nostalgia and just bringing stuff back without a fuller kind of cultural and economic appropriation of it.
Yeah. I mean, just look at this. I mean, the right wing, push in Europe is all about sort of frustration with immigration and demographic change.
Yeah, and stuff, exactly. Change.
And, you know, I don't want to just dismiss that as, you know, just racist, you know, chuds or whatever. I mean, I think a lot of it is expressed in a racist way, but like, that is, unfortunately, I think, I mean, look, that ship has sailed. Like, what are you guys going to do? I mean, leaving aside the economic question, which is why that's happening in the first place, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, what are you going to do? Are you going to have a racial pogrom? Mm. It's not going to happen. So no. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what people expect. I mean, I think the thing is, you got to take the society that you have, and that's your way forward. You're not going to be able to like cleanse it. I mean, I guess you could, but then you're really lost. Hmm. You know, so it's got to be some vision that is not backwards looking; it's forwards looking. Like, you got to take your the situation as it exists today and be forward looking. And but that politics is super confusing. You know, there was a really interesting viral video of Tucker Carlson, who I find very interesting. You know, he's got a bad reputation, obviously, but I find him a very interesting. I don't, you know, I think people should distinguish between finding someone interesting because they seem to be speaking genuinely, mm-hmm. versus, oh, I love this person, I agree with everything they say. Right?
Yeah, a decade ago, you wouldn't have had to qualify this.
Yeah, now it's like, okay,
yeah. Whose talking points are you? Yeah, who are you standing for? Exactly.
But he goes to Australia and he gives a speech, and this Australian reporter starts asking him that question, like, okay, you know, you've talked about the border crisis and, you know, like, how do you answer for, you know, wanting to return the country to white people? And he was like, did I say that? Did I ever say that? And she's like, yeah, well, you're hinting at it. And he's like, I never said that. I just thought that was interesting because it was like this, this struggle.
Asian Australian.
Yeah, but it's the struggle between people who have, I think, a certain, they're like, to her credit and to the credit of that viewpoint, the shitlib viewpoint, there is a recognition that, like, the society that we have is the one that we're going to have to build a future around. And she's accusing Tucker Carlson and his support for policies that restrict immigration to say we cannot absorb any more immigration into the country lest we completely lose, you know, a sense of in and out, you know. And her reaction to that was just, well, that's crypto white fascism. Yeah. And he was like, I seriously, you know, and he's like, I really never said that. And I think, you know, everyone who's in here, who's rightfully here, is part of it. You know, I'm just, that's in, you know. I just think that's very interesting because it's kind of like this they're both in a way looking towards the future, you know, but they don't trust each other, right? They don't trust each other. And he thinks that she's completely, you know, bought into this liberal ideology and just wants to, you know, take down white people and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And she thinks that he's a crypto white fascist and he doesn't say the thing that he really wants to say, which is we need to get rid of all the non-white people. And, you know, the fact that they can't have a civil discussion around something as not straightforward, but something as legitimate, a political discussion as immigration policy, you know, which is, you know, should not be off the table. That should not result in that. That's not out of bounds. That's legitimate policy discussion. Yeah. They can't have it. They can't have a civil one. Yeah. And they're not even from the same country.
It just shows you the same ideological or cultural sphere. It doesn't get more kind of supposedly coherent than that sort of Anglo-American sphere, and yet they can't. I mean, she might as well have been from Virginia. It doesn't matter.
Exactly,
side of question, right?
They're the same.
But it's really interesting. The lifeblood of this of democracy is supposed to be rational discussion. It isn't just voting, of course. It's the ability to have rational debate. And that's exactly precluded by the way they talk.
You can't have rational debate. You can't have rational debate if you mistrust the motives of your opponent. You know,
if you interpret everything in terms of motives, if there's no such thing as an argument on its own merits, it's about who's saying it.
Everything you're saying is subterfuge to advance. You know, another thing that you're hiding.
Yeah.
And I know you're hiding it, but you won't admit it. And so my job is to just force you into admitting that that's what you're doing.
So you have ruled out democracy. You can't have it anymore. If it's just that, and you cannot have it under those conditions.
Yeah.
And we don't have democracy because of that. I mean, I'm not saying this is the cause of it, but this is another symptom of the kind of the degeneration of the discourse. I think Tucker's frame of reference is slightly wider than hers, an ability in terms of it having an openness to learning something and to something different, to opposing viewpoints. Hers, which is basically the shitlib view, is just you're either with us or against us, right? It's the discursive counterpart of that. You're either with us or you're the fascists. And
it's true though her view
absolutely nothing in between.
Her view has a legitimacy in the sense that there are a lot of white nationalists and racists and xenophobes and that kind of thing. And he's just saying I'm not one of them. You know, but her point, I think her viewpoint is that those people exist and he's giving
you're
them
talking
cover.
Like them. Yeah, their views exist, and you are repeating their talking points, and therefore you're one of them.
Which isn't necessarily wrong either. You know, I admittedly that there is some truth to that.
No, but this is the shit that they teach you not to do in college, right? Don't people have these writing classes or these, reason and rhetoric or, you know, philosophy 101 or whatever it is, right? Critical thought classes in college. This is just wrong. This is just fallacious reasoning. But I'm already sounding like some old git talking about it like this, because I mean, it's just wrong. It's an ad hominem. You don't conduct debate like that, right? But this is the norm now.
It's like a Tower of Babel thing. It's like
you just lose the ability. A Tower of Babel.
It's starting to fragment more and more, and there's more distrust being sowed all the time.
Yep. Yep.
And people will not listen to each other because we don't trust each other. It's like, why would I listen to you if you're lying?
Yeah. Getting back to your point about retrieval, how do you retrieve anything?
Yeah. I mean,
this is what they say about the language for rational debate or for rational discussion.
Yeah.
For rational disagreement or even agreement. Because if you can't disagree, you're not really even able to agree, actually. People don't notice that. All you're doing is conform. Nobody's going on the basis of arguments. That sounds so old-fashioned. It's my group, your in-group, or out-group.
But I guess what I'm saying is that I don't see this as a loss of behavioral norms or rhetorical standards. I mean, it is that, but that's not the primary cause. So I don't think fixing that's the issue.
No, it's not.
I think the issue is that we just do not trust each other. We just don't trust each other. And, even if
why
I
don't
were
we trust
to,
each other, though, then why?
You know, interesting. I gotta say, man, I remember... I had a very clear vision of this once. I was like, this is ages ago, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I was living with my now ex-wife. And, things in my life were kind of not going great. You know, I was having trouble with my marriage. I was having all sorts of things. And then, so just to kind of like, you know, I'd go up to we have a roof deck on our building, and we'd kind of go out, hang out there and smoke a cigarette or something, have a drink. And I just saw all the apartments around me, you know, and everyone, I could see through their windows, and everyone was watching TV or something. And what normal, say, I'm not saying there's anything weird about that, but it just kind of started, I'm just like, holy shit. Like, people are so segmented. It really hit me because I felt segmented. You know, I was like cut off from my, you know, any just I felt really cut off. I was like, there's no vein of like familiarity here. Like, the city just seems so like just one massive stranger. And that itself didn't bother me so much, right? But it's this idea that, like, I think that's kind of like what everyone else sees it as too. I mean, with exceptions, of course, but like, largely, I was just like, it's a city full of strangers. And the level of, you know, we talk about in the abstract, like atomized society and, you know, all this stuff, individualistic culture of the self. But when you really kind of like grasp it or see it for what it really is, it's kind of horrifying, I have to say. I felt a bit horrified by it. And the vision of that made me change my priorities wholesale. Like, I specifically remember that moment where I was like, I can't be like that. You can't live like that. That's annihilation. So, but I do feel like there's a lot of people who are, I can sense that they're sort of boxed in by that. They're a victim of that. And yeah, I don't know what I'm trying to say with that, other than I think that's what people should be resisting. You know, in your life, like, I think that's, if there's a project in your life, it's to get out of that box. Don't live a compartmentalized life. Don't get, you know, don't get trapped in, you know, a self-centered frame of mind. Because it's a dead end. It's an absolute dead end. And when you see the end, it's really horrifying. And I think there's a collective that scales up to the collective, as well, where when you realize that the path that you've been on this whole time is actually a dead end, and all of the valid and rational criticisms that were warning you about this whole time, which you dismissed for all your various, you know, with all your various tools of self-defense and rationalization, dismissed all those criticisms out of hand. When you finally see the end for yourself, you know, like in the pod that you forwarded me, they were talking about how reality comes smacking into the present.
Yes.
That's what I'm talking about. The reality of the end. Not the end of life, not the end of the world, not the end of... I'm talking about the end of this way of life. Right?
The end of the illusion. The end of the... Yeah. Yeah.
And then all of those built up layers of criticisms and warnings and all that stuff, which were dismissed out of hand, you know, a red mark was put on it and it was tossed in the rubbish. Suddenly all those things all at once become valid again. And that's a scary thing, because there has been criticisms and warnings about this the whole time. And when the reality finally hits, it sort of like brings back to life a lot of things that were dismissed.
Everything,
and that
comes,
can be a scary thing, because you have to admit that a lot of your enemies and adversaries were right the whole time. And that's a scary and almost humiliating sensation, to be like, I was completely fucking wrong.
There are elements of the phenomenology of a kind of repression here. Everything that's repressed comes back in not necessarily pleasant way.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier hypernormalization. Is it then
the Adam Curtis thing? Yeah.
Yeah. And before him, and he was just taking from, was it a
Russian,
Soviet guy, a Russian
Soviet
thinker?
Guy,
yeah.
Yeah. Who was describing sort of like the last few years of the Soviet Union.
When people created a kind of systematic denial of a kind of reality that systematically denied the actual reality, right? That the system wasn't working, and so you create this thing, and it becomes the hypernormal. But at some point, it becomes.
It's almost like normalcy almost becomes a ritual that you're. You're practicing being normal as a ritual.
It becomes the normal. I guess the idea in hypernormalization is that your set of delusions, your fantasy world, becomes accepted by everyone and becomes a kind of normal, and people live by it, react to it. People conduct their politics by it. Certainly, in the U.S., you wage war based on this. And at some point, or you run a presidency based on this, and then at some point it breaks, and then reality comes rushing in. Yeah.
Yeah. His description of hypernormalization was basically that, you know, in the Soviet Union, everyone knew, for example, that the economic situation was a lot worse than they were officially saying it was, right? Everyone knew, but nobody really did anything or never really remarked upon it. I mean, they would talk about it, but it wasn't, it just became sort of like, you know, water cooler talk, you know. His point being that although it was clear that it was sort of end times for that that epoch, right? Like that whole way of life was going to go away. And something really terrible was right around the corner, which was the total collapse. And we're not just talking about the breaking apart of the Soviet Union, but we're talking about like a decade of like misery, you know, or more.
It's not the end of an entire order. In fact, the end of the entire country as it was, right?
Yeah, the whole project is gone.
The whole project and the country is gone.
But his point was that the reason, but people nevertheless carried on in their day-to-day as if everything was fine. And you even see this kind of like, you know, I saw this in pictures out of Ukraine where there's a war going on, but, you know, people are still commuting to work. You know, life still kind of goes on, despite the fact that it's an utter bizarro world that you're living in. And his point was that because nobody was offering any alternative, people just stuck to what they knew because there was no alternative. And the failure of any, you know, other party or any other competing politician or anything to say, look, there's another way to do it. We're going to change. We're going to do this instead. In the absence of anyone offering a compelling alternate system, you just stick to the one you know, because people will stick to the system over
over
nothing, right? Like people are they're just going to kind of go along with the pretense that this whole thing still makes sense, not because it makes sense, but because there's really no alternative. And I think that might help explain like why the, you know, like in that podcast when they were saying just like how incredible it is that we perpetrate these lies over and over again about how like the war in Ukraine was going fine, Russia's about to collapse, it's but not this week, next week, and then oh, not this week, next month, and so on. And it just keeps, or with Joe Biden's fine, everyone's being ageist, and you know, this is just a political hit, and they go with this lie up until the point where they put them on TV for the world to see, and they're like, wait, shit, the critics were right. And why do they allow it to happen? Because I think it's the same thing, they just don't know any other alternative, you know, they just go with it, they run the cover in the media, they just run the same PR strategy over and over, even though it makes no sense anymore. They don't know what else to do.
And this is just my view of it. I may be wrong, but you know, I can't get around this sense that, look, these guys knew. They can't have been that bought, you know, into the... They can't have been drinking the Kool-Aid to the extent that they didn't notice that there was something wrong with the president. Everybody else knew.
They knew.
The rest of the world knew. So they kind of knew.
Yeah,
but then they were in that hyper-normal. Yeah, they did it anyway because that was the normality that they created and everybody's supposed to be sustained by it. You know, and what was amazing was that collective shock horror when they saw it. But it's not just that they saw it individually. I think it's the shock horror of the world seeing it, of all of us seeing it together. So they could dismiss, you know, clips. If you made a certain clip of it, you know, there are many, countless clips of Biden doing weird shit, right?
And every one of them had an explanation, you know, like something was happening.
They could explain.
Off the frame and you couldn't see.
Exactly. But I think there's an element of only some of you saw that. Only some of you saw this one. And so we can maintain the illusion. But a presidential debate is almost a kind of enactment of something universally seen. Oh, that's when it shouldn't appear. Because he wasn't that... He's done more bizarre stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the funniest thing. He wasn't even that bad by his own standards.
He wasn't even that bad. It was that he was bad in a way that we all saw it together. So these people were looking out the side of their eye at the next person in their reaction. It's that I can't... bullshit, I can't gaslight you anymore because you have all seen it together with me. But if it was just something sort of partial or what, I could just dismiss it as right-wing talking points or whatever.
Yeah.
That's the amazing thing about these people. They're still in this world.
Has there ever been a better real world embodiment of the emperor has no clothes in that moment.
Man, yeah, I can't.
I mean, that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, that was it.
That was it.
He's
been naked all this while. And why did you guys pick this moment in particular to all cry out in surprise?
Yeah.
Somehow it's because we were all in the room together, figuratively, because it was the debate. And they were all sitting there, and then suddenly the horror comes to them. And I bet it's not even, they're not even aware of this. It's not that they colluded among themselves, okay, this is the time when we all freak out over this. Suddenly, that combination of the publicity of it, and the publicity of it has a lot to do with it, right? And they're all, I think suddenly the publicity of it broke the dam.
Isn't this why we have these myths and fables to help us explain these things?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, isn't it obvious? Like, it seems almost juvenile, right? Like, it seems almost, not juvenile, but it seems quite elementary.
Yeah, it seems elementary. Yeah. We're in the world of the mythic and storytelling, which is their world. They've chosen to dominate this world, right? You've got outsource all your industry, all your manufacturing. And so you are the champion manufacturer. You're the champion industry of the virtual, of talk, of discourse, of narrative in particular. And all of a sudden, when it doesn't work anymore, it's an almighty crisis. And I believe these guys, they're not, their reactions are genuine reactions, but in the context that I described, I think. I mean, they are shocked, and you just have to wonder why they're so shocked. Panicked. And they're panicked. Yeah. It's incredible how these guys get their knickers in a twist over this. The rest of us have been looking at it going, look, we've been telling you this, and you don't, you know, you call this right-wing nuts and whatever, right?
I mean, but think of yourself as some official in the Democratic Party or in Biden's team or whatever, and it's like, okay, fine. Let's say you believe it. What are you going to do about it as one person? Like, what are you going to do about it? Hmm. You know, is there any reason for you to stick your neck out? There isn't. I mean, even if you kind of know that this whole thing, this whole charade is going to be up, I mean, better than to stay out of the, stay out of range of the flak and protect yourself and just let it happen. You know, I mean, I think the idea that there is, that these are a group of highly coordinated people that have a singular goal and that they're willing to make sacrifices and do courageous things like say the truth when it's an unpopular truth to say, well, that would only make sense if there was some higher shared goal and that's what that was in service to. But I don't think they do. It's careerism. You know, like people are just,
it's just
a collection of people that are, you know, angling for jobs and jockeying for position. That's all it really is at the end of the day.
Well, they are the people that you saw that night from the roof.
Yeah.
Each reacting in their own way like that.
That's the end of part one of a two-part podcast. As usual, the second part of the podcast will be on the Patreon feed for Patreon subscribers only. If you want to support Plan A, go to patreon.com/planamag.